Hi, welcome to True Creeps, where the stories are true and the creeps are real. We'll cover stories from grotesque gore to the possibly plausible paranormal, to horrifying history, to tense and terrible true crime, and everything else that goes bump in the night. We're your hosts, Amanda,
and I'm Lindsay, and we want you to join us while we creep.
We cover mature topics. Listener discretion is advised.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to our 21st True Crime Digest.
It's of drinking age.
What a time. When we started doing these originally, we were doing them every month. And then we were like, this is one quarter of our episodes. This is too much. So now we do them sporadically, which is why it's only our 21st, I guess. But in case you don't know, True Crime Digest episodes are where we give case updates on episodes we've already discussed. Sometimes we'll cover new cases in these episodes too. But we've got so many updates that there won't be any fresh cases. Just fresh updates. Because it's also been since November of last year.
Yeah, but it's a good thing. It's good that a lot of these cases are moving along.
Yes, yes. Some of these cases are as far back as our first few months in True Creeps. So we're going to give a brief recap of each case before we get to the updates. So if you haven't been listening to us forever, still worth listening to, because you'll hear a little bit about the case. You'll hear what's going on. And then you can go, I want to hear more, the full length episode on any of what we're covering today. They'll be listed in the show notes. So it'll say the name of the update and then the full case episode name.
Yeah. So let's get right into it. The first update we have is for Aisha Degree. I occasionally will find myself just looking for updates on it, even when we're not going to be recording, because I'm invested and this family deserves to know what happened.
And we do that for a lot of our cases because we're like, it's also the algorithm has learned what we want to know. So a lot of them just pop up organically.
Oh, yeah.
Which is lovely to see that, like, we're like, oh, something's moving along. We're getting information. Love to see it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I love to sometimes our listeners will send us messages on social media when they find an article. And some of them are like local articles, so they're not going to come up very often unless we're like seeking them out. So thank you to those that do that. But Aisha Degree, I think it was last week, I was just scrolling and I was like, oh, there was an interview done by her cousin that I just sat and watched. And I was like, I need to know more of what is happening for this family. But let's go ahead and do a quick recap. So on February 14th of 2000, Valentine's Day, 9-year-old Aisha Degree went missing from her home in Shelby, North Carolina. Aisha was seen by drivers, and she was walking along Highway 18 in Shelby. So a rumor that we had talked about, right, was that she had been seen being pulled into a 1970s green Lincoln Thunderbird or a similar vehicle. And you and I had gone through and were like, let's find anything that was sold around that area that looked like this for a while. Aisha, since that evening, has not been seen. On August 2nd of 2001, evidence belonging to Aisha was located in Burke County, North Carolina, on the side of Highway 18, approximately 21 miles north of where she had last been seen. A construction crew working in the area located the evidence and turned it into the Cleveland County Sheriff's Office. Numerous items of evidence were collected from the area, some having been identified as belonging to Aisha, and other items not belonging to her. In our last update, we talked about search warrants that were executed in September of 2024. So it's been a little while.
Mm-hmm.
Details about this are in our True Crime Digest number 20 episode. Overall, a ton of evidence was collected in relation to the Dedman family, and we had talked about them as well.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of information about the investigation came to light in February of this year, so the 25th anniversary.
Mm-hmm.
We are going to talk about evidence found in relation to the Dedman daughters. We are primarily going to be talking about two of them today, and their names are Lizzie and Sarah. Lizzie was 16 when Aisha went missing, and Sarah was 15. A witness came forward who had gone to parties with the sisters in the early 2000s. On one occasion, while at a party, he saw Lizzie upset and intoxicated. He then heard Lizzie say, "I killed Aisha Degree." Like, if you shivers down your spine?
Yeah.
Ugh. Okay. So then he also heard Sarah say, "Shut the fuck up." Interesting. Like sisters chit-chatting while drunk, I guess.
Sistering. Yeah.
Yeah. This was surprising to the witness because this was unlike how he typically saw Sarah act. They gave the witness a polygraph, which they then passed. Which, again, we've talked about that before, but still interesting.
We don't always believe polygraphs, but I don't always count them out. I think that it's kind of a totality of the circumstances thing where they interviewed a bunch of times and they gave a consistent story where they not showing signs of like deception in their body language. were you able to corroborate that they went to parties with them from somebody else, right? So it's like a, if everything else checks out, this kind of just adds to the weight of credibility, because we're going to talk about somebody else who had a polygraph in just a moment, and where I'm like, yeah, I kind of trust that polygraph.
Yeah, I think it's a tool that you can use along with other tools.
Yeah.
But it can't be a singular tool.
Yeah, yeah.
Also, interestingly, law enforcement found some texts between the sisters too. And today, Lindsay and I are going to read them.
Mm-hmm.
If there's inflection in how we read them, that's our interpretation. So text messages are kind of tricky because you don't really know. And we don't know their personalities or how they speak or anything
yeah,
like that.
Yeah.
Like, I think like when we text each other, I can put the inflection correctly.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Not with a rando.
Exactly.
So because we're going to be reading the text messages, to make it make a little more sense when you're listening, Lindsay is going to be reading the text from Lizzie, and then I'll be everyone else in the text string, but we'll make sure to name who we're saying.
Yeah, obviously that means that Lizzie is one of the most consistent people across all of the text messages. It's either just one person or Lizzie and someone.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So all of these text messages happened around September of 2024 when they executed the search warrants, which is very interesting to think about.
Mm-hmm.
The first text exchange happened on September 10th of 2024, and this is just from Sarah.
Mm-hmm.
Sarah, they think it's our shirt. It's not her shirt. Sarah again. Her mom said it wasn't hers. Sarah, I don't remember that shirt. I'm scared, though. Dad is probably going to be a huge suspect.
And just as a note, that was for the conversation between her and Lizzie. So and I think that's fair. Also, it's interesting to me that in 2024, people are talking about evidence as though this text conversation can't be the subject of a search warrant. Like, this is accessible by law enforcement. It seems bizarre to be texting about it.
Mm-hmm. It does. Very Lori Vallow.
Mm-hmm.
So the next day, September 11th, 2024, as a note for this text exchange, Anna is another Deadman's sister. And all of the text messages I'm going to read are from her to Lizzie. So Anna said, Lizzie, you don't need to be talking to anyone. I'm at the lawyer's office now. Another text. They advise we should all not talk to them without representation.
I mean, duh.
Interesting. So another text exchange from September 11th, 2024. And this conversation is between Lizzie and her ex-husband. So Lindsay will be Lizzie.
Yes. This is going to get nothing but worse. I'm talking to my doctor at 5 to get something for my nerves. I'm just so worried. So, so worried. I mean, it's a nightmare that's going to keep getting worse. I can see nothing good happening anytime soon. And I'm an optimist.
Her ex-husband then said, oh, no, I hate that for y'all.
And again, Lizzie, there is no way this is going to be okay.
Okay. So then the next day, September 12th of 2024, this conversation is between Lizzie and Sarah.
So Lizzie says, I just talked to David Teddy. That's the family's lawyer, by the way. The theory is I did it. Accident covered it up.
Sarah says, no, why would it be you?
And Lizzie responds, that's what he said.
Okay. So another text exchange that also happened September 12th of 2024 was between Lizzie and her ex-husband.
So Lizzie says, I feel so horrible. So, so horrible. I don't know what to do. I caused this.
Her ex-husband responded, no, you didn't. Again, on September 12th, 2024, this conversation happened between Lizzie and Sarah.
So Lizzie says, hey, is everybody mad at me?
Sarah replies, nobody is, Lizzie. This is not your fault. And not your fault is all in caps. Then, a little while later, September 29th of 2024, this conversation was between Lizzie and Sarah.
I'm just so anxious about, like, what's going on behind the scenes. Like, what are they doing now? What's going to happen to me since I wouldn't talk to them? And as we'll mention in a moment, there's a point when she stops going in and talking to police and stops cooperating. And this is around that time.
Yeah.
And so Lizzie continues, I'm afraid it's going to get worse. Well, he told me it's going to.
And then Sarah replies, I know, girl, I'm a disaster. I think if they come at you again, you just go and be compliant. That's what I'm planning on doing.
And so Lizzie says, I think so, too. Honestly, I mean, I want to do what Dad says, but damn.
Sarah says, and maybe we should have let you do what you originally wanted to do.
And Lizzie says, I don't know. I really don't know.
Sarah says, right. We don't want something we do or say to impact him, but we also can't be living like this either. I mean, I told him I'm not going to do that.
And Lizzie said, right. Oh, you did? What did he say?
Sarah said, it's not like worth our mental health.
And Lizzie responds, right?
Sarah said, he was just like, I will call Teddy. We can go get a polygraph with the honest people.
And Lizzie responds, oh, okay. And by the way, that's O with like several H's. So it's definitely, oh, okay.
Yeah. And then Sarah says, I really don't have it in me to go through what you have been through.
And Lizzie responds, it's been hell.
Sarah says, just hearing about your situation has made me a disaster. All caps, hearing about it.
And Lizzie responds, oh, I'm sorry.
Sarah then says, I just can't even imagine going through that.
And Lizzie says, but y'all have dealt with other stuff that I haven't.
So this is a strange text exchange, I would say.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a strange text exchange. From this exchange, what I think happened is that what Lizzie is perhaps talking about, this is complete speculation, is that I think that she gave some tip that spurred the most recent types of evidence being looked for.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's going on. Because the phrasing of like, I don't want to do something that will impact Dad.
Yeah.
What would you do? Because from my understanding, the businesses that they were once involved with, they aren't anymore. Because I could see if he was like a small business owner and if they answered wrong, the public was going to drag them and then it would impact his business. But that's just such a specific thing to say, is that I don't want it to impact this one particular person. Or I feel like if there was some concrete way that this would impact their family, they would say it like that versus just one person, right? So if somebody had a business or somebody worked at like a school where that would just maybe be a problem, right? Like if it was going to impact the entire family, you would say that versus just their father.
Exactly. Exactly. So obviously we hope more is coming of this.
Mm-hmm. Also, just as a note, Amanda mentioned it earlier, the green Thunderbird or like car. When they executed that search warrant, the family was in possession of a car that looked like that. It wasn't a Thunderbird. It was, I think it was a Rambler.
Yeah. Yeah. There's pictures online of mm-hmm. it, too. And makes sense, right? Because we had speculated just that it was that era of car.
Mm-hmm.
Because like if you see it very quickly, especially at night, it's going to be hard to, you know, recognize.
Yeah. I also think that when I think Thunderbird, I am thinking of an era of car. I'm not thinking of a particular model.
Mm-hmm.
Just like if you somebody said like 90s sedan, you might have like a Corolla in your head.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't mean that it's necessarily just a Corolla.
Yeah. Yeah. There was one article that like showed a picture of the 1973 Ford Thunderbird and then what was taken from the Dedman residence. And it was a green 1964 AMC Rambler.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, of course, they're complete different cars, but, like, I could see the similarities as well.
Yeah. But also, it was nighttime, so trying to see a dark car in the dark.
Mm-hmm. Just an old car. Yeah, like, an old school car that was green.
Yeah.
And especially in such a small area, too. Like, okay, makes sense. So, investigators asked Lizzie to take a polygraph, and she did. She answered no when they asked her whether she was concealing information about Aisha's disappearance, and the polygraph showed that she was being deceptive. Since then, she hasn't really cooperated with the investigation.
One of the things that I think is important to consider when looking at Lizzie in particular's polygraph result is these text messages where she's saying she's anxious, she's saying she's nervous, she's saying she's stressed. That could cause a false negative or like false deception in a polygraph test.
Oh, interesting.
Like the person's mental state just being chaotic or anxious in and of itself, that could cause that because they're so loose, I guess. And like, it's not an exact science. It's not, if this shows, it's definitely a lie. It's showing that that person is having some type of feeling with it. I'm not saying that I think that she was or was not honest. I kind of think that she's not being honest and that somebody in her family has something to do with it. But yeah.
Something.
Something.
Yeah, there's something there that is worth exploring. And in May of 2025, the reward in relation to Aisha's case was raised to $75,000. And I know her family is still out there doing interviews when they can, especially when it was the 25-year anniversary. They've been all over. They're still fighting for her. And I want to say one of them mentioned like, oh, she's still alive. And it broke my heart that they're like waiting for her.
Well, and I think that one of the hardest parts here is that I don't think I could ever just fully accept someone's death if they just disappeared. I think that there would always be this part of me that hoped until I had full closure. So one, there's that persistent hope that almost it's so persistent that it hurts. There's that. But then on top of it, you really can't start to grieve until you know what happens, like truly, like really fully grieve. So I feel like you're in this just liminal space where you don't know. And like, how do you get your brain to stop? How do you focus on anything else other than that when somebody you love is just gone?
Mm-hmm. I found the article that I had seen a while back. This was from February of 2025. And Aisha's mom was interviewed and she said, I believe she's still alive. And until somebody can prove me wrong, I'm still going to believe that because all I have is hope.
Yeah.
And when they did this interview too, they're standing in front of the sign that, you know, we talked about in the original episode. It's still there.
Yeah. That's so heartbreaking.
People are still dedicating time and money and resources to it. Mm-hmm. It actually like makes me really happy for this area.
Yes.
Because, I mean, imagine driving by that sign every day. It's been a long time.
It's bad enough that whatever happened to Aisha happened to Aisha. It's made worse by the fact that there's not an ending. And we really both just hope that their family gets some closure. So the next case we're going to talk about is the Deltona Massacre. As a recap, Troy Victorino and his group murdered 6 people in Deltona, Florida. They were 22-year-old Aaron Bellinger, 19-year-old Michelle Nathan, Francisco Ayoroman, who was 30, Anthony Vega, who was 34, Roberto Gonzalez, who was 28, and Jonathan Gleason, who was just 17. At the time of these murders, Victorino had had a long history of violence and abuse, and he coerced others in his group to take part in the murders. And the people in his group were Jerome Hunter, Brandon Graham, Michael Salas, and Robert Cannon. Bizarrely, the catalyst for the violence, which was extreme and grotesque, was a dispute over belongings, including an Xbox, which Victorino believed had been unfairly taken from him. And this is one of the reasons that some people refer to this case as the Xbox murders.
Yes.
Victorino, Hunter, and Salas were ultimately arrested and convicted of the murders. And we previously mentioned that Troy Victorino and Jerome Hunter were being resentenced, and the jury returned a verdict of May in this year in that resentencing. Now, originally, they were both sentenced to death in Florida, but the law in Florida changed to require that for capital murder cases, the jury had to decide unanimously. And in the original case, they did not. However, like I mentioned a moment ago, in May, the jury did unanimously recommend the death penalty for Victorino and Hunter. Now, the judge in this case will ultimately decide whether they will be sentenced to death, but a decision has yet to be rendered on that. It looks like later this month, there will be another hearing that's coming up.
Yeah.
So one of our oldest cases, this is our oldest case that we're going to update today, is the Jatluff Pass. Now, we're going to give a recap. It's not enough. There's no way to do a recap on Jatluff Pass that is enough to really get what happened. But in one sentence, the Jatluff Pass incident, it was a mystery about a group of hikers whose remains were found in a bizarre scene in Russia. There's tons of details.
Very bizarre.
Yes, incredibly bizarre. There's tons of details and conspiracy theories that range from government problems to aliens to everything in between. So if that is something you're interested in, you should check that episode out. It is, I believe, episode 10. So one of the earlier ones.
Forever ago. Yeah.
So you would think that this incident that happened decades and decades and decades ago, we would have all the photos from it. But you'd be wrong, because new photos were found this past May, and they were from one of the original investigators. And
that's why.
Yeah. And so they found 2 photos. They were stuck in between journal pages, from my understanding. And what's so important about these is that the photos give a clearer picture of the order of events that occurred during the investigation. One of the concerns about just the order of events of how things were found, and specifically whether the den was found before or after the remains were found. And as a reminder, the den was the shelter that the victims had built in the ravine. Mm-hmm. So it was unclear whether they found bodies or this makeshift shelter in the ravine first. The photos confirm that the den was found first.
Interesting.
Yes. And they also provide a visual match to the clothing that some of the people were wearing, because I don't think they had photographic proof of everyone and what they were wearing. It was based on reports and journal entries and things like that and what was left behind. So they knew a little bit clearer on that. But very interesting.
Yeah.
As always, our sources are in our show notes, but we have the pictures that you can look at on there, too.
I like that occasionally, because we had signed up for any updates, like they have a website for it.
Mm-hmm.
And so occasionally I'll be scrolling through our email account,
mm-hmm.
and it'll be like, update. And I'm like, what? And I'll click on it and be like, my gosh.
And that's how we found this one out. Yeah. Was from our email.
It's crazy to be like, oh, now there's pictures from 1959 that have just come up.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
Yes.
Anyways, so another update that we have is for the Mercedes Vega case. And so that one's a local one for me. As a quick recap, Mercedes Vega was abducted from her Tempe, Arizona apartment around 9 p.m. on the evening of Sunday, April 16th of 2023. That same evening, only a few hours later, she was found deceased in a Chevy Malibu that was set on fire in Tonopah, Arizona. According to the medical examiner's report, Mercedes was shot in the arm, hit in the head, had bleach in her throat, and eventually died of smoke inhalation while being burned alive in a car.
Horrific. Horrific.
Now, we have a full episode with the timeline of what happened. We've also covered case updates and our True Crime Digest updates since then, too. Also, we've talked to her parents a couple times
yeah.
in between that. They're wonderful people. But in our last update, we noted that Cujo Young had been arrested, and that was for a prior armed robbery against Mercedes.
Mm-hmm.
But there were some big case updates right after our last True Crime Digest.
Yes.
So let's talk about the updates since then. So during their investigation, law enforcement found fingerprints on a cup that was found inside the burned vehicle with Mercedes. The fingerprints were a match to a man named Jared Gray. So security footage and the Chevy Malibu's OnStar data showed that the car was at Mercedes' apartment garage the day of the murder. The OnStar data showed that the Malibu and Mercedes' car went to the location where Mercedes' car was abandoned. And we talked about that in the episode, mm-hmm. too, because I went there mm-hmm. afterwards, actually. I Google mapped the heck out of it, like everything. But me and my sister-in-law drove from her apartment complex to where her car was abandoned to just like get a feel for that drive, too. So that's crazy that both cars. I think you and I had speculated that both cars made it there.
Yeah.
But for sure, Zeus, they did.
Yeah. And one of the things that we did in terms of research was Amanda and I very meticulously drove the possible routes on Google Maps and marked down every major building that was like a big corporate building. And we looked at the different ones and we found ones that we were like, you would have a clear shot of the road here from the front door.
Yep.
And we emailed those building companies to see if they had security footage. This was because we were in contact with Mercedes' parents. We were like, if you have it, please send it to them. And the responses that we got was that they weren't able to help, which is unfortunate. But they did respond, which I was impressed by at least. But I'm glad that they could pick up the route with the OnStar data, which, by the way, yeah. what an ad for OnStar data.
Right, right. Well, that and then just it made sense. Like when I went there, especially at night, and I was like, oh, this street is horrific at night. It's dark. It's like a dead end over here. Mm-hmm. You could do anything. And so that was just terrifying because there's like an apartment complex very close, but there's a big fence. But anyways, it made me sad that that is available so close, especially to the college and bars and all of that, that there's just this like dark, horrible street that things like this happen at. So the Chevy Malibu was bought on OfferUp. And the folks who picked up the car said that Cujo Young paid them to pick up the car. And originally, Lindsay and I had found it auctioned. Like it was auctioned off first and then somehow mm-hmm. afterwards made it to OfferUp.
Yes.
So after that, DNA to a man named Sincere Hayes was found in Mercedes' car. So that's three people now. And we had talked about three people at least being involved. So then on top of that, cell phone records of Young and Hayes show them in the same areas as the vehicles on the day of the murder. That led to arrests.
Mm-hmm.
In late 2024, Sincere Hayes was arrested in Tennessee and extradited to Arizona. He was charged with first-degree murder, kidnapping, robbery, and vehicle theft. So Hayes was charged in relation to Mercedes' murder, but also for the previous armed robbery that Young was arrested in connection to as well. Prosecutors are seeking the death penalty. In June of this year, Jared Gray and Young were charged in relation to Mercedes' murder. Gray was charged with murder, kidnapping, armed robbery, and theft. Young was charged with conspiracy to commit murder and kidnapping. Young allegedly bought plane tickets for Gray and Hayes to come to Arizona from Tennessee.
So it really does feel like he was orchestrating this.
It really does, yeah.
And his previous armed robbery case is still continuing. It's been delayed many times, but it is still going. And it is heartbreaking that if he had been promptly held responsible, Mercedes might be alive.
Yes, I agree. And our hearts go out to Erica and Tom.
Mm-hmm.
Those are her parents. We've talked to them a couple times, and we are excited that there has been movement in the case and they're finally taking stuff seriously that they've been screaming at them since the beginning. But we really hope for the best and we'll continue to follow it.
And we really do hope that there's justice for Mercedes, because heartbreaking.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And after speaking to her parents several times, right, like just hearing it in their voices.
Yeah.
After every phone call we've had with them, we've had to take a little while and be like, this is so much. And our hearts just like feel for them. And we want law enforcement to do what they're supposed to be doing. Yeah. And just it sucks.
Every time we talk to them, we hold our shit together while we're talking to them. And then Amanda and I talk about it afterwards. And then we cry.
Every time.
Because we're just like, it's the fucking worst. And it's been a moment since we've talked to them. But on the times that we have, we would hold our shit together while we talk to them. But then afterwards, when we were, it was just like the two of us chatting, that's when we would kind of fall apart. Because we were just like, it's horrendous. And it's one of the worst things that a person can experience. And to have to feel like no one's trying for justice for your kid, yes, on top of the loss is,
yeah,
unfathomably bad.
They're grieving and having to work at it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just not fair.
Yeah. Yeah. Again, the fucking worst.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're thinking of both of you.
Yes. Yes. So speaking of the fucking worst, let's talk about Donald Studi.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So our original episode about him was quite a bit ago, and he's a possible serial killer in Iowa. Just as an interesting note before we get into our recap and updates, the last time we did a Donald Studi update, we also did a JLF Pass one. So I was like, huh. That's interesting that they're update buddies, because they're not similar at all.
No.
Let's do our little recap. One of Donald's daughters, Lucy McKitty, has been claiming for decades that her father was a serial killer. Lucy, now in her 50s, claimed that when she was a child, she was forced to help bury her father's victims on the family's property. Her claims have varied, and they've included that he's murdered somewhere between 5 and 70 women. That's a big fucking range,
insane,
right?
Yeah.
We have an entire episode on the case. I think it is fascinating. Now, law enforcement has excavated areas where the family used to live, but Lucy is adamant that when law enforcement did that excavation, they did so in the wrong spot, and that she told them this, which sounds maddening. It's also this massive sprawling space. It's owned by somebody new. They've been super down to help with whatever, right? Which, as one should be, if you think that there are bodies on your property, you should want to find out. And I'm going to be really suspicious if you don't want to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It is a costly endeavor because this is a small community and they obviously don't have money to do like excavation and such like that. And I think that part of the issue here was the fiscal component, because I don't think that they had the budget to really be able to devote the funds that were needed to do this. So two Los Angeles production companies are financing a private investigation into this case. And this has helped fund not just the investigation itself, but testing that's been done and the equipment that they'll need to do these, because they've done additional excavations.
Yeah.
And so I just think that's really interesting, because I don't think I've seen yet where we've had media companies come in at the onset and go, let us help you investigate. Like, you want answers. This is going to be covered by the news. Let's make this mutually beneficial.
Yeah.
Interestingly, Lucy, her contract with them, it's a no money contract. She just wants to prove that this happened. She just wants these victims to have justice, because she's been carrying this with her entire life, because it was her father and she was there and he made them help him.
Mm-hmm. I can't imagine what she's gone through.
No, no. And so we'll talk more about what the production companies have done and how they've helped in some specific ways later. But since our last update, there have been other people who have come forward with claims about Studi generally. But we've also heard from a lot of people who are bolstering Lucy's word, who have talked to her or have some type of relationship with her. And they're like, no, we believe her, which I think is very interesting, because you don't always hear people coming out going like, this person's credible.
Yeah.
But I think here we have such a horrific story and not a lot of evidence of the murders themselves. Just like this proven track history of a shitty guy who does shitty things to people.
Yeah.
And then a lot of death around him that seems very suspicious, even with people whose deaths are known about, like all of his former wives and his children saying he was abusive.
Yeah. And we've even run into someone who we were talking to that knew her.
Mm-hmm.
And we're like, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yep. So just interesting that organically,
yes,
Lindsay and I met someone who brought it up.
We were like, tell us everything.
Yes.
Because it is such an interesting case. And I feel like when you hear from families of people who are murderers, most of the time you're hearing about the weight that they carry with them, knowing that their family member did something like this.
Yeah.
And I think that she has her entire life been trying to be loud about this, but no one ever listened. And I think that she's just gotten to this point where she's like, I can't hold on to this anymore. But anywho, let's get into these updates.
Yeah, I think that's fair. That's a lot. So there were reports of a massive FBI file on the investigation into Studi, and it's over 600 pages. It's not available to the public. Hopefully, eventually it will be. It's possible that Studi was an informant for another case and is named numerous times in the document. So that would mean the file wasn't a massive investigation into Lucy's claims, but more of an accumulation of all the information that Studi provided to the FBI.
Yeah, so like just because there's an FBI file on him doesn't mean it's for murders. It just means that he has an FBI file.
Mm-hmm. In a previous episode, we mentioned how one of Lucy's sisters, named Susan, originally said her father wasn't abusive, but she since talked about how he was violent and abusive. She still doesn't back up what Lucy said happened, but I mean, it's hard. It's hard to talk about when you had a shitty childhood to anyone, especially like the public.
Also, older generations are not as forthcoming with all of the family dirty laundry.
Yeah.
They're much more of a, this happened in the family, we just keep quiet about this, that you don't share things outside. And in addition to that, it is completely possible that Susan does not remember.
Yeah, that's true too. Or put it out of their head.
Because you never know how trauma can affect a person.
Yeah. Lucy's aunt, Marilyn Kepler, believes everything Lucy has been telling law enforcement. Marilyn also notes that she detests Lucy, which is interesting.
Yeah, I'm like, she's like, I fucking hate her, but I believe her.
But she's right.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
I feel like that makes it more believable.
Yes,
like, you
yes.
Don't like someone, but you're like, but they're right.
Yeah, I feel like if you have two friends that don't like each other and you ask them for advice and they both agree, you're like, okay, I guess it's what I got to do. Because
yeah,
I can take this to the bank, you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So yeah, it feels legitimate, I think. But interesting, though, they're like dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
In 2020, Marilyn handwrote an account of the Studi family history, which is apparently pretty fucking bad.
It's also almost 200 pages, by the way. It's fucking long.
That's sad. That's sad. 200 pages of terribleness. Mm-hmm. Like, that sucks. She gave it to her daughter, who we believe now has a Facebook group, to share the details about the history of the family. We applied to join, but haven't been accepted yet.
The rules are not very intense. I was very intrigued by it because Lucy also has a Facebook group where she shares updates and mm-hmm. Facebook suggested this other one. And I was like, oh, no.
Yeah. And sometimes for these groups, too, when you have any association to a podcast or media, mm-hmm. sometimes they won't accept you. I know that happened with a lot of the Lori Vallow ones, too.
Mm-hmm.
That some of the family members had, once they see that you're part of a podcast or media, they don't want you.
Yeah, in my profile photo, it has a microphone in it. So there's no yeah. hiding the fact, which I'm also cool with because I don't want to sneak into any group where no. we're not supposed to be.
Yeah, yeah. And if we were to ever share anything, we always ask for permission to, by the way, if it's not public.
Yeah.
So Marilyn's writings talk about the family history of abuse, robberies, murder, and arson. This account includes allegations against Studi, like that he burned her home down after he had an argument with her husband.
Ugh.
Yikes. Marilyn said that he would burn down homes in insurance fraud schemes as well. She described him as a murderer as well as a hitman for organized crime. Marilyn describes an envelope he kept on top of the fridge that had information and photos of people he was hired to kill. Just terrifying.
Fucking yikes. Yikes.
She said he carried a cement-filled pipe that he would beat people with.
That is very specific.
Yes. Yeah, it's not like, oh, he'd carry this knife or this gun. No, mm-hmm. this is something very uncommon, I would think, I would hope.
Yes.
Marilyn was released from prison because she is terminally ill. And she was in there serving an 8-year sentence for aggravated assault.
And I think that that is also why she was doing this handwritten account, because mm-hmm. she wanted her daughter to have it.
Yeah.
And so she gave it to her because she was like, you should know what happened with our family, because she's Studi's sister. So when we say Lucy's aunt, like paternal aunt.
Yes. Yes. So those who interviewed Marilyn said that her stories were credible and she consistently described the events she recalled. So like she didn't alter her stories. Mm-hmm. They were very exact.
Yeah. They weren't getting more fantastic as she went on or darker or anything.
Yeah. And about 15 families of people who have gone missing have reached out to Lucy to see if their loved ones could have been one of Studi's victims. It doesn't seem like there were any connections between the women that Lucy remembered seeing and those whose families had reached out to her. But who could know, right?
Yeah. And we talked about this in our original episode as well. But per Lucy, Studi's victims were women who their disappearance may have been overlooked. And that's very similar to the victims of Samuel Little. And we've talked about that before.
It is. Yeah, that's who I think of immediately.
Yeah, he described them as grapes. He would just come pick a grape because he knew he could come back and pick another and no one would stop him. And vile, just vile and disgusting.
Horrific. It's hard to imagine that this is our world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So one of the production companies, Lee Enterprises, interviewed Lucy's therapist, Lisa Persian. With Lucy's approval, of course, Persian said, quote, considering her childhood, she's incredibly stable. She has suffered a lot of trauma. For people who don't really know her or understand her, her stories can sound outlandish. But I don't think she's a pathological liar. She's very consistent. And she has no motive to make these kinds of stories up, because who would want to make these stories up about themselves or their family? Absolutely true. Like, why would you want that? Mm-hmm. I don't want that media, you know? Persian noted that she didn't think that Lucy was doing this for money or fame, which tracks because, from what we understand, her contracts with the production companies are no money contracts. So she's not getting anything out of this. And it seems like she mostly just wants them to fund the investigation, which, like, imagine screaming, there's a problem, over and over and over again. And everyone's like, probably not. Like, not taking you seriously.
You're like, oof, there's some bureaucratic red tape.
Yeah.
Best we can do is go, oh, well. And I think that part of the reason for that is because Studi has died and because of his victim pool. I think that if these were women who they didn't deem having a high risk lifestyle, there would be so much more
outrage.
There would be so much more resources being poured into this. Like, if it was a case where it's been unsolved for dozens of years, where everyone really wants it to be solved, versus someone who they're like, oh, well, that person was a sex worker, or, oh, that person was unhoused, because for whatever reason, law enforcement has decided that they aren't deserving of justice in the same fucking way, which is gross.
Yeah, we see that a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So Persian also said, quote, it's been important to her since she was a very young child that those bodies in the well, if there are, which I do believe, be put to rest, that they finally have a proper burial. I think it's really important for people to realize that she has no motive.
Mm-hmm.
A former FBI agent, Stuart Fillmore, has spent a significant amount of time interviewing Lucy, and he also believes her story. He said, quote, I've had numerous conversations with Lucy. When I first started talking to her, just the stories, it just seemed outrageous, really. But the more I kind of dug into it, I found her credible, to be quite honest. The more I listened to her and got more of the details of it, just the way that she could recall things, she was consistent. So that's multiple people that you would trust, right?
Mm-hmm.
FBI agents, therapists, people that would be recognized for finding flaws in people's stories.
Yeah, yeah. And it's also people that do not benefit from bolstering her story.
Yes.
So let's talk about a new witness that's come forward. And they spoke with one of the production companies, but under the agreement that their full name would not be shared.
Fair.
But we do have his first name, and his name is Robert. Robert said his experience with Studi, which occurred in 1975, scarred him for life. At the time, Robert was working at a bar in Iowa and was cleaning up. Studi came in and was chatting with him. He bought him a few drinks, and then he offered to pay Robert $100 to help him move something. I feel like $100 today, if somebody's like, can you just help me lift something, is a surprisingly good amount of money. So I was like, what is that inflation? That will be $617 today.
That's a lot.
But anyway, Robert's like, okay. So he follows Studi and he drives his own car. So he doesn't drive with Studi, which is good. And so he follows him to Green Hollow, which is the area where they lived. They park. Studi takes Robert to the back of his truck, which was covered with a tarp. And then in the interview, Robert said, there was a tarp over part of the bed. And when it came off, I looked over and there's this body with tennis shoes sticking out. I just met this guy. He was nice enough to me, but he lifted the tarp and there was a wrapped up body in the back of the truck. You can imagine the trauma I felt. It was crazy and the paranoia set in. If I didn't do it, he could just kill me right there, right? That's the only reason I did it. And so he helps him carry this body. And Robert said he remembered Studi telling him that the body that they were carrying was a woman's body.
It's horrible.
So Robert starts to help Studi carry this woman's body into the woods. He mentioned that she was wrapped in something white. So I don't know if it was another tarp or plastic or sheet or anything like that, but something white. So they're carrying this woman's body into the woods. And he's like, I just keep seeing her tennis shoes. And that kind of, I think, burned into his brain, like that particular image. And as they're carrying him, he's like, I can't do this. And he's expecting Studi to attack him and kill him because he's holding a murder victim in his hands, right?
Yeah.
And Robert recalls that Studi was like, it's all right. I'll pay you. Just go wait for me by the truck. And so Robert heads back to where the cars are parked, but he doesn't wait by the truck because he's pretty sure that Studi's going to kill him if he stays. So he leaves.
Yeah.
And he's just held this with him his entire life. Like, it's just stuck with him all this time.
That's terrifying.
Yes, yes. And I don't know why he didn't come forward sooner. Maybe because he did help carry the body and, like, you would be considered an accessory after the fact.
Maybe. I mean, fear.
Yeah, I said there's a lot of things with fear. But I think coming forward now, it's just another person bolstering Lucy's story with no benefit to themselves, right? Like, he's like, I don't want to get famous from this. I don't even want you to share my name. I just want to prove this is the truth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that and, like, he could face issues from the story as well.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk a little bit about Studi's former wives, one of which was Charlotte Studi. And you're going to see an interesting pattern that the wives' names are often the same as the daughter that they have. So Charlotte's daughter is named Charlotte. And Lucy, who we've been talking about, her mom was named Lucy. Isn't that interesting? I don't meet a lot of women juniors. When I was a kid, my mom did Girl Scouts for most of my life. And when I would answer the phone, I would say, like, hello. And they would say hi. And they're like, is this Susan? And I'm like, no, that's my mom. And routinely people would say, is that also your name? And I remember thinking that was very bizarre because I had never met a woman junior. Not to say you can't or shouldn't. I just thought it was interesting because I was like 10 and a 10-year-old named Susan seems silly. But my mom was 10 at some point, I'm sure.
Maybe.
But anyway, we're talking about one of Studi's wives, Charlotte Studi. So when she died, her death was ruled a suicide. However, she was recently exhumed and a new autopsy was performed. The pathologist was Dr. Aaron Lind at the Douglas County Medical Examiner's Office. Dr. Lind said the initial findings of suicide didn't make sense to her, because it appeared that Charlotte had not been shot at point-blank range, as the previous autopsy had said.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. Rather, it said that she had been shot from further away.
It still blows my mind that you can exhume a body months or years later and still figure that out. Like, science is crazy.
Yeah, and I mean, I would imagine, like, especially with, like, a rifle shot, that's pretty fucking intense, right? So depending on how the bones look, even after, like, severe decomposition of everything else, the bones, I think, would show the wounds in a way that would help you gauge distance.
For sure. It's still years and years later and being able to determine it.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
So one of Charlotte's daughters, the one that wasn't named Charlotte, her name's Marie McGovern now. She said, I was 15 at the time, and I've never believed it was a suicide. The minute I got the call, I'm like, oh my God, he finally succeeded. He just didn't put her in a well.
Yikes.
Yikes. In an interview, Marie said that Studi had beat her mother often. And in one instance, she got between Studi and her mom. And then Studi pulled a rifle on her. She ran from the house.
Ugh.
Now, the production companies that we talked about earlier and the testing that they paid for, this autopsy and the exhumation of Charlotte Studi were things that the production company paid for.
That's awesome.
Yeah. It's good that they did it. It sucks that they had to.
Yes. Yes. Agreed.
So Dr. Lind also notes that it would not have been possible for Charlotte to have shot herself with a rifle while sitting in the driver's side of the vehicle where she was found. She was 5'2", and her arms were simply not long enough for her to have been able to distance the rifle from herself in the way that it was and fire it. And there's no evidence that they're aware of, which we'll mention in a moment, that would reflect that she used something to, like, push the trigger. And also, like, a rifle trigger, I would imagine, would be a lot harder to, like, push from a distance with something than a smaller gun. I don't know. I don't know about guns.
Depends on the rifle.
That's fair.
But, yeah.
But, like, that still seems like a strange way. And why would you do that if you were going to?
Why?
Yeah. If your goal was to end your life, you would do it in the way that is most likely to do that, which is to get it as close to you as you can.
Right. And not create more questions, too. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. So ultimately, Dr. Lind's autopsy report listed the cause of death as undetermined. And that was because she was unable to give a definitive ruling of homicide because police documents like crime scene photos and the original autopsy file were missing.
That's bizarre.
Which is strange in and of itself. Like, why? Why are those not there?
Yeah.
So Charlotte Studi's other daughter, Charlotte, said, through our lives, we did not talk about it. We were told, you know, just let it go. And we're not letting it go. We need to find answers. We need answers for us to get the peace we need. Which is so fair. We've said it over and over again. Like, how do you get closure if it's just a big question mark? And if you're like, I know this person, I know what could or could not have happened.
Yeah.
And we'll talk about another situation that makes it even more likely that Charlotte was possibly murdered, because we're going to talk about another situation that is eerily similar to this particular scene.
Yeah.
So Lucy's mother, mentioned a moment ago, also named Lucy, died of hanging in 1970. When we refer to Lucy's mother, we're going to call her Lucy Studi, full name, every time, just so that it's clear that we're talking about her and not the Lucy we've been talking about all episode.
Yes.
So when Lucy Studi died, the family was living in Denver, Colorado. Lucy was found hanged to death in the home, but in particular, she was found in a closet that was right next to the kitchen. And there was evidence that she had been beaten and there was blood. Like, it was clear that there had been violence at some time before her death.
Yes.
On top of that, that closet that Lucy Studi was found in was incredibly small. So small that Lucy Studi's knees could touch the floor.
Hmm.
So it begs the question, how could she have hanged herself in a place that was so small? Because generally, if your body has the reflexive capabilities to do so, you will save your own life, even if you do not want to.
Yes.
So like, say you were like, I want to not come up from water. If you have the reflexive ability, your body will push you back up, right? Like, you're going to flail.
Yeah. Yeah. As long as there's no other outside intervening waves or whatever it may be. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. And so in the same thing for this, right, her legs would have kicked. She would have pushed herself up in a way that would have prevented her death. So I just find that incredibly suspicious that anyone would look at this scenario and say that it was actually suicide.
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
Yeah. So the Denver coroner's office has agreed to re-review all the material and look into Studi's case. But this has not yet happened. And that re-review has not yet happened because, from what we understand, two of Lucy's sisters have not yet consented to the autopsy and re-review. And that information is from that Facebook group that Lucy runs. So that's her perspective there. So that is interesting, looking at a case unfold from someone who is in it, because you can see like their actual perspective on why things are or not happening.
Yeah.
Also, she has a lot of questions as to why Susan has such a different story, because she's like, this is what happened. Why are you saying this isn't true when it is? And which I think is interesting. And if she was lying, I don't think she would draw attention to the fact that her sister disagreed.
I think so, too. Yeah, it wouldn't be in her best interest.
Exactly. So Marilyn Hill is the daughter of another one of Studi's former wives, whose name was Barbara Rich. Marilyn recalled that Studi was terrifying and that her mother was physically and sexually abused by Studi, sometimes in front of her and her siblings. Disgusting.
Yeah.
So another person who has come out and give more information about their experiences with Studi was the mother of Studi's first child, whose name has not been released. And she talks about the times that Studi tried to kill her. In one instance, she was pregnant and she was fleeing from him on foot. He chased her in a car. And so she was running through lawns to get away from him. And he was driving through the lawns to get her. She would circle back behind the car and he would like reverse and go forward and try to hit her over and over again. In another instance, she was in the car with her son. Presumably it was parked and she was in the driver's seat. And he came up to the driver's side with a gun and threatened her. And remember, that is how Charlotte Studi was found. She was found in a parked car in the driver's seat, having been shot. And I find that very, very alarming.
Mm-hmm.
So there's been so much more just surrounding information that's come out in the past year or so.
Yeah, from various people, too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so that makes me believe it more. There's various people with like different relationships to others who are like, yeah, I saw that, or I experienced this, or he freaked me out. Like, there's too many consistent stories of like what kind of a guy he was.
Yeah. From people who wouldn't necessarily be in cahoots, if you will.
Yeah. Yeah. Nothing to benefit.
Mm-mm.
And honestly, it just makes them get more attention that could not be great.
Yeah.
And they're willing to still like go through it. So just interesting. That's terrifying.
Yeah.
So that concludes our updates for the cases today. There are a few others, like Lori Vallow had another complete trial here in Arizona. Somehow it always lands when I'm out of town. I don't know how they do it, but every single trial has been while I've been out of town. And I don't go out of town that often.
Amanda's a jet setter.
I'm a jet setter. We'll be looking over that too. We've posted the outcome of it.
Mm-hmm.
There's also been another interview with Lori Vallow from our favorite Nate Eaton that literally came out a couple days ago. So we'll be reviewing that and either chatting about it or posting about it eventually.
Yeah.
I'm just happy to finally, hopefully, have her out of our lives. Like, she can just rot alone with no attention.
Yeah, I'm fucking done talking about her. I think that she likes all of this attention, and that makes me feel a rage.
Yes.
Like a very intense rage. It's hard to conceptualize just how angry you would feel if this was one of your relatives and she's soaking in the limelight of the horrendous fucking things she's done.
Yeah. And always trying to play with the media. It's so weird. She's so fucking strange.
Fucking always.
Gross. But anyway, so we'll deal with her eventually. But as always, we'll continue to provide case updates in our True Crime Digests. We'll also share case updates on social media when we stumble upon them, since these episodes are so sporadic. And again, thank you to anyone who sends updates, especially like from the small town newspapers and stuff.
It's yeah. Really
interesting, because we may not see that otherwise unless we're looking for it.
Yeah. And I think that we may try to be a little bit more purposeful about putting case updates in the Bat Bonfire, so that there's like a place where we can repost things like that, because we don't always want to like repost someone else's full post on our page, if you will, or our, like our Instagram or something like that. But this way we can post it within the Bat Bonfire. So, you know, see it, chat about it.
Yeah. And that's a Facebook group that we have that's open to everyone.
Yeah.
So if you want to join that, and if there is a case that you want to discuss, throw it up on there. That would be interesting to read about.
Yeah.
And we've brought this up several times, but if there is a true crime case or paranormal thing, anything you want to talk about or you want us to talk about, send us some episode ideas. We love it. We've done several this year already. We have a list of them. There's some that we've already started researching. It just takes a couple more weeks or months, because there's a lot, but we do appreciate it. And so we thank everyone that's sent us them, who sends us updates on things that they see and just interacts with us on our Patreon group or Bat Bonfire.
Yeah.
One of my other favorite things that people send us is measurements, like how people measure things with other things.
Yeah.
And I laugh every time you send them. So yeah. I appreciate it.
It's like, I feel like it's one of those types of humor that I will always find funny. Unless it's like just fucking respectful. But like generally when they're like, this is a corgi sized shark. And I'm like, for like, yeah. I appreciate that you were like, I'm going to describe it with the first word that comes to my head, because that's so clearly what it is, unless they're just trying to be goofy. But like, chef's kiss, always a good time.
I saw one earlier that said it was half a giraffe.
Which half?
Yeah. What? You can't just fold a giraffe in half. Like, what do you mean?
Yeah. Like the long side or the
body, the neck?
Yeah.
So I love every single one. So thank you. Those make my day. And then already we're more than halfway through the year, which is insane to me. I feel like it's January still. But, you know, 10,000 degrees outside.
Yeah, we're near in the end.
No, don't say that. I can't. But October is coming faster than ever. And so our listener stories episode will be then. And we would love to get your story. So head to our website. There's a whole area to submit your stories. You can record them and email them to us, or you can write them out and we'd be happy to say them. You can remain anonymous. You can put your name. Totally up to you. But we would love to hear them and share them in October. So send them our way.
Yeah. Yeah. And with that, have a good weekend.
Thanks for creeping with us.
Thanks for listening. And as always, a special thank you to our patrons who support us via Patreon.
Please see the link in our show notes to learn more about how you, yes you, can begin to haunt the dump, guard vortexes, or even become a scorching Sasquatch.
Ooh. Also in our show notes, you can find the link to our website, more information on our sources, our social media handles, and our merch store.
We'd love for you to keep creeping with us. So if you like this episode, please subscribe, rate, review, and share the show with your fellow creeps and or ghosts.
I beg of you. Hey, everybody. Welcome to True Digest. Woof. Already fucked up. Wow. That's a new record. Less than 20 seconds in. We'll keep going, though.